seal out drafts, dust, and moisture with MD brand weather stripping from Menards. A well-sealed home is more comfortable and energy efficient. We have the largest selection of in-stock weather stripping with over 100 products available to take home and start lowering your energy bills today. Save big money on weather stripping right now at Menards and check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. This is continuing coverage in the trial of Donna Adelson from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
Back when I think I got a cell phone, we had a plan with a certain limit. Now they're unlimited, but that was one of the reasons why call detail records were created, correct?
Certainly, billing purposes, yes.
And what about network load?
As far as the creation of records?
Yes.
So network load, there are reports that I spoke about, the kind of specialty reports that are more of an engineering standpoint and are used by carriers to more effectively manage their network. Amongst other things, might be load be something that they would be considering with those records.
Now, the call detail records that you've testified about extensively over the last couple of days, they do not contain precise geolocation data for a handset, do they?
The majority of the records that I've spoken about, no, do not.
And specifically, the records that you relied upon for mapping purposes that you displayed earlier.
That is correct. All of the records used for mapping are strictly cell site locations. So the locations that you've seen were for the cell site or cell tower the handset was communicating with, not the cell phone itself.
And using the cell site sector, you can at least identify where on a map a handset could be.
Correct.
And so when you're mapping, those dots that are on your maps, those are the cell sites.
That is correct.
They're not the handset.
Correct.
Now, there are variables that influence how a device, a handset, communicates with a network, correct?
Certainly.
Would some of those include the signal strength of the handset?
Signal strength, or really signal quality, is one of the primary things that a handset uses or the network uses to determine which cell site a handset may communicate with. So the signal quality is largely affected by signal strength, as you ask, meaning the closer you are to the tower, the stronger the signal is, generally the better quality the signal is.
Now, what can interfere with a phone or device connecting with a tower?
A number of things, primarily structures, buildings. Here in downtown, we have a number of cell sites around the area. And if you were behind this courthouse, a very large, substantially built building, and there were a cell site on the opposite side, the density of this building would probably prevent your handset from being able to communicate with that cell site. And you may choose a cell site that's somewhere else that your handset is better able to see. Topography, hills, valleys, cell sites that are on the other side of a mountain, your handset may not be able to see or communicate with. Those are really the primary things, bodies of water, but the physical obstruction, topography is probably, to me, the greatest effect.
What about network load on a specific cell site?
So load can be a factor. The handsets, as they're creating energy, this radio frequency, the signals that are going back and forth, it is a bit of noise. And so the towers, if there's a lot of handsets, that can create a lot of noise, which can affect that signal quality that I've been speaking about. So towers can choose to adjust. Breathing is sometimes what it's called, but there may be an adjustment by the tower or the network. If there is high density, then handsets can communicate with other cell sites. generally, no matter where you are, your handset is able to see multiple cell sites and sectors at the same time. And there's a lot that goes into the choice of particularly which one of those your handset is directed to communicate with for any particular event.
So merely because a handset is communicating with a specific cell tower, cell site, sector, that doesn't mean that that's the closest one to that handset.
That's correct.
Do the call detour records that you have relied on in this case take into consideration whether or not a tower is under maintenance or partially functioning or otherwise operating at a reduced capacity?
Only in the respect that if it were not functioning, then it would not be listed in the records. If it were not operational, the handset would not be able to communicate with it. So when I see a cell site and sector in the records, I know that it was operational because the handset did in fact communicate with that.
But there's no way to tell from the call detour records that you relied on here whether or not a specific cell site was partially functioning.
I don't know exactly what you mean by partially functional.
Well, were any of them operating in reduced capacity? You can't tell that from the call detail records, can you?
I could not tell the load or the capacity on the tower at any particular time, no.
And so you just listed a number of factors that can affect call routing and cell site selection, correct?
I did, yes.
Now, those same factors can influence when a call is handed off to another cell site, correct?
They can, yes.
And so not only in this instance do we have a handset that is moving on a highway, but you also have those other factors that could influence what cell site the handset is communicating with.
That's correct.
And understanding all of those variables, that's critical to you analyzing and interpreting the data.
It is, yes.
And so would you agree that the analysis that you conduct has some inherent limitations?
It certainly has limitations as far as nothing in the analysis that I've done is meant to say exactly where a handset is. We're unable to do that. Again, I talked about inclusion and exclusion, that we know the general service area of a cell site. And so we include and exclude locations, but the limitation to the effect of we cannot say exactly where a handset is correct.
And so in other words, it involves some degree of estimation or inference?
I would agree with that, yes.
Now, could you pull up the presentation that you were showing us earlier?
I do have it, yes.
I want you to turn, let's start with one thing that the state brought out. Let's go to the frequency report. I believe it's on slide 28.
Apologies, a little trouble getting back there. Slide 28, the frequency report for Donna Adelson.
Okay, can you explain to the jury again the process of creating this report? I believe what you said yesterday was that you put the data from the carrier into a tool.
A program, yes.
Okay, and then you did the same for Charlie Adelson's CDRs?
Correct.
Catherine Magmanawa?
Correct.
Sigfredo Garcia?
Yes.
Luis Rivera?
Yes.
Anyone else?
Really, most any set of records that we had, the frequency report is one of the first things and most basic things that we do with the records.
Now, there's a process that you have to go through called, I believe it's called deduping. Are you familiar with that?
It depends on which way you're referring to it.
Okay. Well, when you're talking about call detail records and frequency analysis, there's a way, and I think you gave us an example yesterday on some of your slides about how one communication event can show up multiple times.
Correct. So we do see with certain carriers that a call that comes in that is routed maybe to voicemail creates multiple events, and it creates multiple records. And some of those will be tied to the same number. Some of them are tied to kind of a not fictitious, but a routing phone number. So they will really count against the frequency for a particular target. But as I mentioned, these frequency reports are very general ideas of relationships and associations. So for these, we mentioned that it does include things like miscommunications, calls that went to voicemail. It may include the multiple events, because those things are generally distributed equally across all the calls. It's not just one phone that's going to create those multiple entries. All phones calling in should create about the same things. So it's certainly not meant to be an exact number of communications. It's just an idea of, again, kind of relevance and association.
Okay, so in that vein, if you could look at let's look at, I believe it was slide 122.
Yes.
Okay, now with respect to this slide, have you gone into the data and manually removed duplicate events?
I have, yes.
Okay. And the same with have you done the same for slides 26 and 28?
Slide 26 is the frequency report for Charlie Adelson, and I believe that 28 is, again, Donna Adelson's. No, I have not removed duplicate events from these frequency reports.
Okay. So those aren't accurate?
They are accurate. They accurately represent, from the call detail records, every time that cell phone number appeared in the records.
Okay, there's a poorly worded question, I apologize. It's not accurate in the sense that there are not 80 actual communications between my client and her son.
There may be fewer. Again, this includes those routed events, the not answered, going to voicemail, all of those are included. Text messages, voice calls, all of those are included in this tallying. It is just from the raw records. Okay.
And so in other words, you see the 80 up there. You recall, I believe it's the AT&T records, could have three separate events for one communication. Is that correct?
They could. That would generally only tally two for a particular phone number, because that third event is generally going to have a routing phone number in it.
Okay. And so this does not account for that?
It does not.
I believe on slide 98, if you could turn to that. Can you keep going? It might have been the next one. Erase this text after you read it. Was the text erased?
The text was still in the iCloud return, so I could not tell you if it was deleted from the device or not.
You never got the handset that iCloud is associated with.
That is correct.
And that would be Charlie's phone.
Correct.
Slide 116. Okay, looks like on this one there are two conversations between Charlie Adelson and Catherine McBanawa, correct?
One is an attempt. So as it says, Charlie attempts, Catherine, this was an inbound that I don't believe was answered or that any actual communications occurred.
Well, so the one event, we don't know what was discussed, do we?
We do not know.
Slide 117. We don't know what was discussed between Charlie and whomever he was speaking with at the Adelson residence, do we?
We do not.
119. We don't know what was discussed between Harvey Adelson and Charlie Adelson.
We do not.
120. We don't know what was discussed between Catherine and Charlie, do we?
We do not.
And we don't have the content of the text messages that data indicates took place.
That's correct.
Now, with respect to the calls to the landline, do you know anything about the signal strength for the Adelson residents in Coral Springs? You know, as far as their ability to connect with local towers back in 2014?
I only know what I have seen from looking at different sets of records. I know that their handsets have events with location that are consistent with their home on a fairly regular basis. I can do analysis and determine if the handsets are home or not. So as to whether that's great signal or not, there are a number of events their handsets are creating with cell sites near their residence that would be consistent with their residence.
I know that there are parts in my house where I can have a conversation, but if I walk into the garage, I don't have a good signal. You don't know where in the house that they were to have any sort of conversation in their home.
I do not.
Now, if you could go to 135. Advance one. So, during this 36 to 48 hour period, does the seven communications or attempted communications between Donna Adelson and Charlie Adelson indicate a spike?
I would not say so, no.
Okay. And for what time period did you review their records?
We have records that span years. And they are a little different for each person. For some, we have several months. For some, we have years worth of records. So I have looked at periods of time for their records spanning several years.
Okay. Now, specific as to Donna Adelson and Charlie Adelson, You have at least 4 or 5 years worth of records for them?
Probably that many, yes.
If not more?
Possibly, yes.
Okay. And so the amount of communications or attempted communications that are indicated during the June 2nd to June 4th, as you refer to it, flurry of communications, 7, is not a spike.
I do not consider it an abnormally high number of communications. Okay.
Now, with respect to the July trip, can you advance to that slide, please?
Apologies, it'll take just a second. I believe that's what you're looking for.
Yes. Now, again, this is... it's approximately 38 hours time period?
Correct.
The 4 communications or attempted communications between my client and her son, those do not represent a spike, do they?
They do not.
And so the flurry of communications that you testified to earlier, at least as it pertains to my client and her son, did not take place, did it?
I'm not sure where the characterization of a flurry came from. I don't believe that I used the term call flurry. We were looking at calling analysis or calling activity during certain periods of time. And the only question being asked of these, of the analysis in this time frame is, was there the potential for the exchange of information from one person to the other? And that's what we see, that there is communication from one person to the other across the subjects during a time frame that may be more significant than others. It's not meant to reflect a high volume or a different tempo of communication, just that there is at least a potential for the exchange of information.
Now, let's talk about the emails briefly. Go to slide 140, please. Now, you testified this morning that this was sent out. Now, Evite is an online platform where anyone can go in and create an event and send out invitations, correct?
That's correct.
Back in 2014, do you have any personal knowledge as to how that website operated?
In 2014, I do not.
And I believe that you indicated that there was an indication that Donna Adelson was unfamiliar with that process.
Correct.
As we sit here today, you cannot testify that Donna Adelson created that event on evite.com, can you?
I can only testify as to the email where she asked if her invitations had been sent yet, and where she describes how she entered the contacts, how she entered the invitees as contacts. That's the only thing that I can take from that email.
Now, also with respect to the emails, there were quite a few search warrants done for email accounts in this case, correct?
Yes.
How many emails were recovered during this investigation?
Oh, how, like, total number?
Yes.
Oh, hundreds of thousands.
Specific as to DonnaHarvey@gmail.com, how many emails were recovered?
I do not recall the total amount.
In excess of 50,000?
I believe so, yes.
In excess of 70,000?
I don't recall, and I've only seen a subset of those.
Who decided emails. What subset you would review?
Florida Department of Law Enforcement.
Let's look at slide 143. And you testified earlier that this was an email from Dan Markell to Wendy Adelson in January of 2024 concerning their schedule with the kids beginning in April.
January of 2014, but yes.
Yes, sorry. Are you also aware that there were subsequent emails and text messages between the two of them where this schedule changed or was modified?
I'm not aware of any changes or modifications.
So you have not reviewed them or you're not aware of them?
I'm not aware of them. I have not seen anything. I have not done a great deal of research into the schedule with the children, but I am, as I sit here, not aware of any changes.
How did you decide to put this email in the presentation?
The emails are reviewed by whomever is investigating the case, assisting to investigate. They're provided to the state attorney's office for a determination as to what should be included in the presentation.
With respect to Wendy Adelson's phone, are there different types of extractions that can be done on these devices?
Yes, there are different sort of levels of forensic examinations that can be done, yes.
And what are those levels?
Well, it kind of varies by device, by time period, by forensic tool, but we generally talk about a logical extraction where we're kind of we're taking the majority of information we can get access to kind of in a logical fashion. If this appears to be a text message, it's a text message. Phone call is a phone call. It is not as thorough as generally what we may consider a file system or a full file system extraction. So those are kind of the basics.
Okay. Which one is preferable when conducting an investigation?
We want the most detail that we can get.
And the most detailed for most handsets is going to be a full extraction, correct?
It would be, but there are a number of things that may prohibit us from getting that full file system or full extraction. Encryption, passwords that cannot be broken, phones that are not supported by forensic tools. We frequently want the full extraction, but are unable to get it.
Now let's talk about Wendy Adelson's phone. Her phone was searched pursuant to consent, correct?
I believe that's correct.
Okay. And there were no limitations to that consent?
I am not the one who obtained the consent or did the examination, so I don't believe there were, but I don't have firsthand knowledge of that.
Okay, well, I believe, are you aware that Wendy Adelson gave a lengthy statement to investigators?
Yes.
And during the course of that interview, she voluntarily provided her cell phone for extraction.
Again, I believe that is correct.
And are you aware that she put any limitations on that extraction?
I'm not aware of any limitations.
And so what type of extraction was done on her device?
A logical extraction.
And as we've discussed, a logical extraction is not a complete extraction from a device.
It generally has less information, correct?
In this case, if you look at the extraction, the forensic extraction, there's significantly less data in her phone extraction than in other devices' extractions in this case.
Yes. Yes, there is less data. But that may be an indication of less data on her device as well.
I want to talk about the morning of July 18th of 2014. I didn't write down the slide number, but you indicated earlier that and you had a slide that Wendy called Donna, Donna called Wendy. Can you pull that up?
I can.
Thank you. What slide number is this?
This is slide 196.
Thank you. So slide 196, your analysis reveals that Wendy called her mother first, correct?
Well, these calls are as noted at the same time. So they're both at 8:09. And one of the limitations we have with some of the sets of records we have is that some were provided with only hours and minutes of call, and some were provided with hours, minutes, and seconds. So these calls actually occurred in the same minute, but it's possible that Donna's call was first.
Don't you have records that indicate seconds?
We do have records that indicate
seconds.
Specific
for this day?
I don't know if we have specific for this day. We have multiple sets of records and multiple overlapping sets of records.
You have been involved in this case since its inception, since Mr. Markell was murdered, correct?
Yes.
And it's typically in your field best to use records that have more data rather than less, correct?
Generally, yes.
Okay. Have you gone back to determine who called whom first?
I have not, but I could.
And so if I were to tell you that records with seconds reveal that Donna Adelson gets a call from Geek Squad and immediately calls her daughter, and then while Donna is calling her daughter, Geek Squad calls her daughter, would that also be consistent with both calls happening at 8:09?
Yes.
And by using the records with more information, you would be able to present this in an accurate order, would you not?
They both indicate the time of 8:09 for the calls. And as discussed or as presented, hopefully, that there was a phone tag that occurred here at 8:09. And so that, yes.
I believe you had moved to slide 210. Now, this is after the text message exchange between Wendy Adelson and Dan Markell, correct?
Correct.
And that's the one where after Mr. Markell had left a voicemail for Wendy. Wendy texts him and saying, swimming won't work today because I'm picking the kids up at 3:30.
Correct.
And then they kind of have a disagreement about the time that Wendy can pick the boys up.
They do.
After Wendy gets that information from Mr. Markell, she then calls her brother.
Correct.
She didn't call her mother.
No.
Now, I believe after this call between Wendy and Charlie, Charlie, I think it's on slide 213, he tries to call Donna.
Correct.
30 seconds, that indicates to you that the call did not connect.
More than likely.
I believe if you go to slide 272. May have gotten the slide wrong. If you can back up a couple of slides, please. So the text, I believe that the state inadvertently mischaracterized the evidence and testimony in the questioning. The last connection to a cell tower for Donna Adelson was at 8:59, not 8:35, correct?
For 8:59, for location, like location that we would use?
Yes.
I don't recall an 8:59 event.
Okay. I'm sorry. So you have the 8:59 as the text message?
That's correct.
And that's from Charlie Adelson's iCloud?
That is correct.
And you don't get location from that?
We do not. And so, probably important to point out, some of these are chats, so they're actually occurring over the data network. They're iMessage versus carrier-based text messaging, where we're more likely to see locations associated with text. So with the iCloud, and knowing that those are traversing the iMessage or the Apple network, it's common for us not to have locations attached to those.
So in that regard, iMessages aren't going to show up in call detail records.
They do not.
Other apps, communication apps, are not going to show up in call detail records.
That's correct.
Now this tragedy took place a little over 11 years ago, correct?
Yes.
And up until your July 10th, 2025 deposition, you had not done the drive yourself, had you?
That's correct.
Did you do any research to determine what construction had taken place at I-95 between July 18th of 2020, of 2014 and July 18th of 2025?
I-95 where?
Where you drove.
Not the... I know that there was a number of changes to I-95 at the area where it separates from the turnpike, the Florida turnpike. I did specifically look at the turnpike in relation to Mr. Adelson's residence to make sure that there had been no changes in the roadway there.
Okay, so the turnpike, it's your testimony that in the last 11 years, the turnpike in that area has not been widened?
I don't recall it has been widened. The off-ramp is in the same location. The aerial photography is exactly the same for that exchange. And again, the drive was done because there was a question raised somewhere along the way about the ability to get off the turnpike and to Mr. Adelson's residence. And so just to clarify that, then that more research was done. And so again, looking at that, there's been a number of changes around that area. Water drainage have been filled in, buildings have been built, all kinds of things have happened, but the roadway itself remains the same.
So again, my question is, has the road been widened? Has there been construction?
There may have been construction and replacement. I can say with certainty, and I can look at it again, but with certainty, the routes, the off-ramps, the exchanges are in the same position that they are. If the lanes are a little wider, there was no significant change in anything about getting off the turnpike and getting over to Mr. Adelson's road.
Sergeant Corbett, I don't know if I'm asking a poor question or you're misunderstanding. Has there been construction on the turnpike in the last 11 years?
I'm sure there has, yes.
Did you do anything to determine if that had happened?
Yes.
Okay. And yet, you're still giving us a qualified answer.
You're asking about widening. I don't recall seeing, and again, the area that I looked at was the turnpike, the off-ramp of the turnpike, the exchange that goes to the east, and then connects with Mr. Adelson's road. There were no changes to that. If the turnpike was widened somewhere, that may be possible. I did not look for that. Again, I'm looking for the path of travel had not changed.
So you looked for records that would be consistent with the state's theory. To establish that the route hadn't been altered in any way.
The question raised was, can you get off the turnpike and get to Charlie Adelson's residence? And the answer is yes.
Now, what were the traffic conditions on July 18th of 2014?
I do not know.
Did you do anything to try to find that out?
I did.
And what did you do?
I tried to research through Department of Transportation if they had traffic and crash data going back that far, and I did not find any.
Is that because the retention period had been exceeded?
Most likely, yes.
What is a retention period?
I do not know the exact retention period.
No. Tell us, what is a retention period?
I'm sorry. A retention period would be a policy of a holder of information for how long they hold that. And so carriers have retention periods for their cell phone records. It may be 1 year. And after 1 year, they purge that data. Could be 2 years, could be 10 years. But that retention period or is a policy for how long they retain records.
And so as we sit here today, do you know the retention period for DHSMV to keep accident records?
I do not.
What about construction records for I-95 and the turnpike?
I do not.
Did you do anything to collect construction records for I-95 or the turnpike between July 18th of 2014 and the present day?
No.
How many lanes were on 95 between my client's residence in Miami Beach and her son's residence back in 2014?
I do not know the exact number.
What about now?
It varies. There were six or more in certain places. There was construction going on when I drove.
What about the turnpike? How many lanes were on the turnpike back in 2014?
Again, varies by the location where you're at, but 2 to 3 in any direction.
And what about now?
Same now. I say same now. depending upon where we're talking about, so I'm looking at a very narrow stretch of the turnpike. Talk about the turnpike, it's in entirety. I'm sure it's undergone a lot of changes.
Now, when you did this drive, you had gas in your car, correct?
I did.
You did not have to stop for gas while you're doing this test drive, did you?
During those particular sessions or sections, no, I did not.
You had snacks with you?
I did.
So you didn't have to stop for snacks?
I did not have to.
Did you stop for any meals along the way during this drive test?
During these particular sessions or sections of road travel, no, I did not.
And there's a reason I'm going to ask this question. How old were you at the time you did this test?
55.
So not in your 60s, not in your 70s?
Not quite.
Now, have you ever driven, been on the highway, got behind a slow-moving vehicle? It frustrates you, right?
It may, yes.
And you have an opportunity to pass them, you drive by, and you see someone older driving.
Sometimes, yes. Okay.
Do you know how fast Harvey and Donna Adelson were driving on July 18th of 2014?
I do not.
And so, not knowing how fast they are driving, can you give an accurate estimate for how long the drive would take them?
I think I can give an accurate estimate based on speed limit and distance, but as far as how they, which is, I believe, substantiated by segments of travel. So the travel from the 832 point to Charlie Adelson's was very consistent with the estimations. The travel from 1053 to the hotel, consistent with estimations.
Well, I want to stop you right there. The 1053 point, can you pull that up, please?
I believe it's actually here.
Go to the next slide or series where we show 1053 to Orlando. Perfect. That section of the turnpike is not as in an area that is as densely populated as the section to the south, is it?
It's not.
Okay. And so the section south on the turnpike, you're going to get more commuter traffic than you will in this section, correct?
I would agree with that, yes. Okay.
And so you're not going to necessarily be in a stop and go traffic as you would if you were to the south.
Usually, yes, I would agree with that.
Now, was anything done, and let me ask this differently. Do you know whether or not at the time Donna and Harvey Adelson left their apartment on Miami Beach to start driving north, had they eaten dinner?
I do not know.
Did they have a full tank of gas?
Do not know.
How many times did they stop to go to the bathroom?
Do not know.
Did they stop to get coffee?
They may have.
This was late night.
I did.
And you're much younger than they were at the time. You stopped for coffee.
I did.
Just a moment, Your Honor.
Go
Sergeant Corbett, you just made a statement that I believe your deposition testimony contradicted. You said the time that it would take to get from their residence to Charlie Adelson's residence. Can you, with the call detail records, place my client, Donna Adelson's handset at Charlie Adelson's residence on July 18th of 2014?
From cell site locations in the records? No.
And at no point on July 18th of 2014 can you place Donna Adelson's handset and or Harvey Adelson's handset connecting to the same cell site at the same time as Charlie Adelson's handset?
That's correct.
So from the call detail records, you cannot testify, you cannot tell this jury that my client was at her son's house.
That's correct.
Nothing further?
Correct.
Yes, sir. Did the text messages place Donna Adelson at Charlie Adelson's house?
I believe the outside your house text message is indicative of her being outside his house.
Okay, that's what Donna Adelson tells us in that text message, right?
I believe so, yes.
And then she has an hour and 6 minutes, was it, of unaccounted for time on the stretch of the drive that's on the same stretch of the drive where Charlie Adelson's house is, right?
Correct.
You got lots of, and did you do this drive in 2025 because the defense questioned the fact that you hadn't done it, didn't know if you could do it in the 2025 depot?
There was a question. As to who raised it, I'm not certain.
Okay, thank you. You got lots of questions about construction on the turnpike. Defense asked if their client could have gotten stopped for that extra hour that's unaccounted for in construction. Did Donna Adelson tell us in that text message where she stopped on the drive? Did she say she was outside of Charlie Adelson's house?
Agreed.
Okay, and then Charlie Adelson gave her his estimated time of arrival at the house for 10 minutes from then. Is that
correct?
Right?
Correct.
If the Adelsons were just driving really slow on that first part of the drive where they have over an hour of unaccounted for time, would they then have had to speed up to normal cruising speed for the second part of the drive where they made it from the 1053 location to Orlando with a consistent amount of time as the estimated time that we see on Esri?
Yes. The second part of that, the second half, if we'll call it, of the trip was done at close to the estimated time. So the speed and travel were close to what would be expected. The first half of that trip, it was not.
Okay. And when you did the drive and went from the 832 or 834 location?
Yes, one of those. Before the end of the 835 call.
Okay. 834 location. When you did that drive, were you able to get on the same day of the week, the same time of Friday night, from that point to Charlie Adelson's house in the estimated amount of time?
I was, yes.
Okay. And same with the second part of the drive, from Charlie Adelson's house to the 1053 location. Was that consistent with the estimated time from Esri?
With just a few minutes, yes. Within just a few minutes.
All right. And you would have been driving in the same conditions in North Miami, same date, same time of day as the Adelsons drove in 2014?
As close as I could get.
And did you say in this the emails for the Evite that Donna Adelson told Evite that she entered the invitees as contacts?
Correct.
In the beginning of cross-examination, defense asked you a bit about the things that could affect cell site towers, several variables that could affect cell site towers. But if those variables existed that affected these cell site towers and kept the cell site towers from having too much load to be able to handle this communication, would we see phone communication with those cell site towers in the records as we do?
Again, if the tower was not operational, no, the handset is not going to communicate with it. But those things, again, when we're talking about the inclusion and exclusion, where a handset could be, we're aware that there may be cell sites that are closer, that may be stronger, bigger, taller. And all of that we take into consideration when we estimate the area that might be consistent with where the handset was.
Is there anything in the records that caused you to believe these records or analysis is unreliable in any way?
No.
Just a second. No further questions. Thank you.
Sergeant, you may step down, finally.
Thanks, sir.
Will this what? Very well. Please call your next witness.
The next witness, based on his former employment, is the witness that we've asked camera not display his face. So I would ask for an instruction on that at this time.
Sure.
More continuing coverage in the trial of Donna Adelson is coming up from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a moment.